The Means Subcommittee on Human Services, Thursday, March 27th. Just think, right around the corner is April Fool's Day. Public hearing on House Bill 5030, Department of Human Services, Health Services. And we're going to continue where we left off yesterday on mental health and addiction services. For those of you in the audience, just to housekeeping, if you have a cell phone on you, please turn it off so that it does not disrupt the hearings. And I see that someone put Pink Rosie in front and Big Rosie in back. And we want to thank Dr. Mesa Hart yesterday for his generous contributions that he made to Rosie. For those of you who do not know, Rosie is there collecting dollars that at the end of session we will turn over to the Oregon Food Bank to assist the citizens in our state that are in need of food. And Rosie likes it when individuals who are testifying are using acronyms. So with that, we will begin our proceedings, and unless Mr. Britton has something that he wants to open it up with.
Madam Chair, I don't, other than to say that next week it's our plan to start Monday and Tuesday with public health programs. So our intention is to hopefully wrap up mental health and addiction services today and then go on to public health on Monday and Tuesday.
Very good. If the members of the panel will keep that in mind, that we're going to try to wrap this up today and so we can proceed with public health on Monday.
Could you draw me a picture here of what you're really trying to say there?
I think you got the list.
I got it, Madam Chair.
Bob Nichols, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, again, my name is Bob Nichols, and I'm acting administrator of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Today we're going to cover three major areas, as I understand the committee's interest. One is the mental health organization reserve issue. I'll give a brief update on where we're at with that. Then we had a series of seven budget notes for alcohol and drug services and one in the mental health area. I'll walk the committee fairly quickly through those, see if there are questions or issues there. And then after that, Madeline Olson will be joining us to describe the budget issues, the impact of cuts, and provide a little more in the way of technical information related to budget. So I will...
You may proceed.
Go ahead. The mental health organization reserve issue has received a fair amount of attention over the last year or so. The Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services and the department have been working jointly on this since it's a shared function between certain parts of the department and our office. We've been working to revise the reporting requirements for some of this time. The issue that came up in summary is that there was at least one mental health organization, actually one county within a mental health organization, that appears to have accumulated a sizable reserve. And there are understandable questions about why that could happen. It did happen apparently over about 5 to 7 years' time. It was in Coos County, and they were one of the original demonstration counties. So their managed care mental health organization goes back to 1995. And it was during that period of time that the reserve funds appeared to accumulate. What we realized in taking a closer look at this, and we've been communicating with LFO, Legislative Fiscal, on this, and we have realized that there were really some issues in our instructions around the reporting instructions and the reporting requirements. They, frankly, were probably not as clear and precise as they need to be. We've been working on that. So that's one of the issues. Another issue related to some of the variable reporting is that there's probably been a lack of consistency in responding to those instructions, and I think that's not simply a learning curve kind of thing. These are complicated issues, and as we clarified how the reports should be provided and what issues, what numbers should be provided in them, that's taking a little bit of time, but I think we're on the right track. I think the consistency is much more there. We're also...
What specific instructions are put in place so that that particular issue surrounding that county, because the question was whether or not the county was not expending the funds on the service, or whether they were holding back on service and creating the reserve over time. So what is being done to assure that the dollars are actually going into patient care, number one, because I think that that was what the concern of a lot of the legislators.
Madam Chair, several things have been going on in terms of reviewing whether that was the cause. There were several things that when we looked at this, is that I understand that Coos County probably, and I'd be happy to be corrected by Barry Cast on this if he has better understanding of it, but probably included some funds that were not, the source of which was not the Medicaid Mental Health Organization in some of their reporting to us. So part of the clarification has been what kind of funds should be reported and which ones should not be. Another part of the clarification has been to establish benchmarks for how much revenue there really should be in an operating reserve fund. So we're trying to do those kind of things. In terms of the access issue, I actually helped to some degree with the review of the Coos County program in particular. And in the last 2 years, they've actually shown a very nice increase in access. If my memory is correct, there was about a 50% increase in the number of people that they were serving over the last 2 or 3 year period of time. We also did a site review with them and worked on a number of quality issues. And I can tell you today that I believe the Coos County program is much more responsive to the requirements, both the quality as well as the access issues, than they may have been 3 or 4 years ago. There is new leadership there as of about 2 or 3 years ago, and I think that the mental health director has worked hard to try to respond.
In your instructions, and not just Coos County, but how much, what is the percentage for reserves?
Madam Chair, maybe Mr. Cass can respond to that.
Please do. Madam Chair, we're not really trying to play a duet here, but I believe our original contract specified a $250,000 reserve, and the reserve in that respect was not related to the actual flow of revenues through the organization. I think some changes in that area are justified. But I wanted to respond to your question, which is how do we know that mental health dollars aren't being spent on something else? And when I think of something else, having worked for a county, I think about oiling roads and parks and all that kind of thing. And the way we know that, Madam Chair, is that in I think it was in the 1981 session when the mental health, the local Mental Health Act was amended, what the legislature in effect said is that these funds must be held and carried over, funds from fee revenue and so forth, and may only be expended for approved mental health services. And that's why the county, every county, maintains a separate mental health account. And in fact, in Coos County, they have one for Medicaid revenues, for a specific Medicaid account, and another called a mental health account. So we're pretty confident that counties are not spending monies that you've appropriated for mental health services on other functions. But it was still troubling, and I very much appreciate Senator Messerly's role in bringing this to our attention so we could understand better the need for changes in our financial management of the program as well as our clinical management.
Is the $250,000 reserve consistent for all of the county programs? Is that a dollar figure that is?
No, Madam Chair. It's an amount in the contracts with the mental health organizations.
Okay.
Most of our mental health organizations are county affiliated, or I should say do business with county mental health authorities, but they are different in terms of their corporate status, and so the reserve is to them, not to the county. So we don't have a definite reserve for the county.
How many mental health organizations do we have?
Madam Chair, we have 10.
So we have a $2.5 million in reserves. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I would need to go back and double-check that to make sure.
Madam Chair, what perhaps what would be the, first of all, with respect to the reserve, that is a minimum amount. to assure that the organizations are solvent in the face of extraordinary inpatient expenses, for example. But maybe the best thing we could do is have our accounting people put together a summary for the past year of each of the mental health organizations, what their reserves were and how they've been accounted for. Because I think you will find that with the exception of a couple of organizations, we really are not in a the mental health organizations are not in a position of carrying large sums of money over from quarter to quarter.
If you could provide that to me, Barry, over a year's time. In fact, it would probably be better to have it over a two-year period of time because you're talking about a time where we've got different fiscal implications. So I think 2 years would be better. And then what their current collectively reserve balance is. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just was going to comment that there are some variables in the accumulation of reserves that we've been able to identify, and it looks like medium to large and particularly urban counties, the demand is high enough there that the reserve issues are certainly less of a concern there in terms of there being a larger amount. It's, in fact, we have concerns that some of them are, you know, barely on the edge in terms of how much they should have to operate a viable business.
What is the gauge? Is it 3 months, 2 months, 6 months? What is the time period that you're using in order to validate the amount of the reserve?
Madam Chair, I if I understand your question correctly, we're getting quarterly reports at this point.
Okay.
Finally, Madam Chair, the smaller counties do seem to have greater variability in their actual costs and their risks. And as you can imagine, two or three very expensive hospitalizations in a county the size of Curry County, for example, can create real financial cash problems. And so there, what you see is, statistically, a lot more variability the smaller the county is in terms of the potential risks. So that was my summary, and if there are other questions, we'll try to respond to them. Okay. Madam Chair, then if there are no other questions on that issue for now, I would like to walk through the seven budget notes related to alcohol and drug and the one budget note related.
I only have one question because I'd like to respond back to Senator Messler. Did you complete a written report with respect to the reserve issue?
Madam Chair, I believe we have. There are several pieces of correspondence that I was able to identify in the last couple of days. Maybe Barry has.
Madam Chair, we did report in the interim, and we will bring a copy of that for the record here. And I believe on at the time that we made that report, Senator Messerly did join us at the table. And I think at that moment we were still in the process of negotiating changes in financial reporting with the mental health organizations. So we'll bring you up to date on that. And by the way, I forgot to identify myself, and I'm Barry Cast, Assistant Director.
Madam Chair, I'll continue on then with a brief overview of the budget notes. The first budget note, and I believe these, I know that these are in your, was it the pink tab section? 4-43 is the budget notes section, so you can look on as I go through these. The first one related to funding shortfall.
And the green tab.
Oh, green. Madam Chair, I apologize. The first one related to shortfall in restoring 37 beds. And we were to report on programs or activities that are to be reduced or that were to be reduced to generate the necessary funds. The former Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs will also report on the restoration of a 13-bed Hispanic program in Eastern Oregon. And I'm pleased to say that we were able to restore the 13-bed Hispanic program. It's operating now by Best Care. They are doing well in terms of accessing and filling beds and moving along quite well. We presented the September 2001 Emergency Board with the full financial report. The next budget note related to fetal alcohol syndrome, and the former Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs was to work with the Health Division, at that time the Office of Mental Health Services, and the Office for Services to Children and Family to develop a detailed plan on fetal alcohol syndrome. And you can see establish and refine data collection, reinforce training, establish consistent referral procedures for public health procedures, and develop a plan to evaluate the activities and services. And on that, the department presented a report to the September 2001 Emergency Board. There was additional information requested and provided. The department subsequently obtained approval to submit a grant to the federal government. It would have financed a pilot program. It wasn't funded. However, the Children, Adults, and Families Cluster did find $50,000 in federal funds to coordinate a statewide fetal alcohol syndrome conference. And the department is also working toward additional trainings. And I think, as I mentioned yesterday, we've been focusing on fetal alcohol syndrome trainings for the 9 federally recognized tribes. I can also tell you that there was a recent conference in Vancouver, British Columbia, and we are making contact with the experts in that area. Apparently, they are quite a ways advanced in looking at some of these issues, and we'll be meeting with them informally, I think, in the next month or two. So we're going to continue our work along that line. Workforce development, that budget note required the former office to develop a quality improvement measure that establishes baseline and goals, addressing the percentage of provider treatment staff that are currently licensed or certified. We reported that actually to the November 2001 Emergency Board, and we continue to implement the recommendations contained in the report, and that includes a proposal for a new counselor certification rule. And it will reduce the amount of time a counselor may take to become certified from 3 to 2 years, so we can move people in qualified ways in a little faster way. Outcome-based contracts is one of the major budget notes that we've worked on, and I think I mentioned that we've reported a plan to the April 2002 Emergency Board. We now have 5 counties that have agreed to be pilot projects for our outcome measurement-oriented contracts for the coming biennium. So we're working with Clackamas, Washington, Marion, Columbia, and I believe the other county is Deschutes County, but I would have to go back and double-check that.
They were Clackamas, Marion,
Washington, Columbia, and I believe it's Deschutes County. I would need to double-check that. Madam Chair, apparently I guessed correctly.
Yeah, another to be named.
That was, yeah, right. Your analysis was the subject of another budget note. We've discussed some of that in the preceding days. We presented a report to the April 2002 Emergency Board. We continue to collect your analysis information on clients or who are mandated. One of the issues here was that if a patient is or a person is not mandated, in other words, they're not in treatment under some kind of a court or mandated order, there are some constitutional issues with requiring a urinalysis. You can always do it on a voluntary basis, and I think wherever that's clinically indicated, it's appropriate to do so. And finally, we're proposing to change the data collection in the future to obtain results of the client's last year analysis test before leaving treatment, which would be a better indication of where they were at by the time that the treatment was concluded, and not rely totally on self-report then or just a certain duration of time in treatment.
What percentage of the clients are court-mandated and what percentage are none in both in OAD?
Madam Chair, I will need to check on that. I will find out. It's probably different with different populations, but I would like to go back and ask our staff to get the correct number for you. Anecdotally, Madam Chair, I can tell you that when I did that kind of work, it was about 80% of the clients, the adults and youth that I served, and I suspect that it's the majority, but we need to get better than anecdotal information for you. The next budget note had to do with prevention funds distribution, and we were asked to develop a distribution formula to distribute prevention funds to counties, and we developed that plan, presented it to the November 2001 Emergency Board. It was approved, and the plans have since been distributed according to that formula. And the last of the alcohol and drug-related budget notes was on gender equity, and here we were required to prioritize family residential beds and seeking gender equity. And if gender equity existed, we were to seek to fund established programs in the assignment of family residential treatment beds that first remedy gender issues. We reported on that issue in the November 2001 Emergency Board. The board accepted the report, and that's the practice we've been following since then. The Office of Mental Health Services had one budget note, and that was a continuation of a budget note that related to intensive treatment services for children. The background of that was that there was considerable concern about whether if we move toward a more managed care approach to serving kids who have intensive service needs, in other words, kids who tend to end up in residential or day treatment programs, there was concern that we not do that in a way that was harmful to the children or the families or to the providers. And we have since worked with, I believe we have five in what we call intensive treatment services pilot projects now. It's covering, I believe, a little over 200 of the 300 and some beds. And we're getting additional data on how those are going. The longest running project is one that we're doing with Trillium. And in that project, we have evaluated it to see that the children are spending less time in the intensive treatment facilities, which is one of the goals. There's actually evidence that if you keep kids in out-of-home placement for longer than about 180 days, they can actually do worse. And so that's an important issue, that if we can assure that kids are spending the minimum amount of time away from home, they're probably going to end up doing better. We've also, in that part of the pilot project, got data to show that we return the kids to their homes at a higher rate. They show more clinical improvement, and also, very importantly, they have a lower rate of readmission to services at the same or higher level. The newer pilot programs now are in Multnomah County, Southern Oregon, and we're recently starting pilots in Clackamas and Washington counties.
Madam Chair, just for the record, Trillium is the latest name and iteration of an organization that people would be familiar with. They operate the Children's Farm Home in Corvallis, the Perry Center in Portland, and the Waverly Program in Portland. And I think it illustrates one of the essential features of these pilots is the effort to put more resources together and to create a system of care rather than just beds or just outpatient. And it gives the contractor a great deal more flexibility so that kids can move at the right time. And that seems to be the most effective way to make use of state resources in serving kids who have mental and emotional disorders.
And what is the capacity with all five of the pilots?
Madam Chair, I'll get the exact number for you. I believe it's about 200 at this point.
Is the Children's Home or Waverly that has the largest?
Madam Chair, that's correct. But again, I would need to go back and double check the exact number. I believe that's around 50 or 60 beds. Madam Chair, that concludes my review of the budget notes. If there are no further questions about them, I can ask Madeline Olson to join us at the table. And
Madeline's right behind you waiting.
I'm going to change seats with her. It's the way I have of avoiding the acronym tax.
You're calling that a tax, Barry? Gee. I called it a donation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
Do you think if we had a state policy to rename all taxes donations, it might help?
You know?
We know taxes is an investment.
That's, you're right. It is an investment. You know, and I didn't pass the hat around. I just thought that the gig would be better. Welcome, Madeline.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Madeline Olson. I'm the Assistant Administrator for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And as I understand it, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how we get the money from the state to the system, what the system looks like, and what I really want to spend some time talking about are the reductions and kind of the effects on the system that we're seeing now and the effects we anticipate seeing in the future, and what the outcome of some of that may be. As you know, and as it's been mentioned repeatedly over the last 3 days, we do most of our work by statute through the local county mental health authorities, both for substance abuse services and for mental health services. That's the place where the planning and the organization comes to bring all of the disparate funding sources together and do the best they can with the resources to create a system of care. We do have a broad array of funding in addition to state general fund and the Medicaid's funds that run either through the Oregon Health Plan or through other kinds of Medicaid programs. We have both federal block grants for substance abuse, which forms about 38% of the substance abuse service dollars that come out through the state, and for mental health, which is a much smaller portion of the total mental health budget that comes out through the state, about 5%. In addition, there's beer and wine tax, which pays for substance abuse services in the local level, lottery funds, which you heard about the other day, and then smaller amounts of federal and other kinds of grant resources.
Madeline, so it isn't confused on the beer and wine tax. There are, and sometimes, you know, we look and we see beer and wine tax, like the city collects. That is not the tax that you're referring to.
There's a beer and wine tax that's levied. There's a pot of money. I haven't followed the detail for quite a few years. A portion of it comes through our office to fund substance abuse services in the communities. A portion goes directly to the counties, earmarked for substance abuse treatment. And then, as I understand it, a smaller portion goes to the cities and municipalities for unrestricted use.
Right. Just wanted to make to clear that for members of this panel who are not aware, because I think sometimes we hear that there's beer and wine tax and there's an assumption that those dollars are all going into treatment or substance, mm-hmm. and they're not.
Thank you. For the non-Oregon Health Plan services, the convention we use for moving the money out to the local governments is called a financial assistance agreement, and that sort of defines the partnership relationship and the funding relationship and the outcome requirements and the other sort of things between us and the counties. Most of the services, in point of fact, particularly in the substance abuse area, are delivered by private nonprofit subcontractors of the counties, some delivered by county government. And in mental health, maybe more are delivered by county government, but a substantial number of mental health services are also delivered by private nonprofits. In addition, for some regional and statewide services, the state contracts directly with private nonprofit agencies or, in a few cases, local acute care hospitals. We also have agreements, as I think was mentioned just recently, with the 9 federally recognized tribes for prevention of alcohol and drug abuse problems. The Oregon Health Plan has a different history and a different way of doing business depending on whether you're talking about substance abuse services through the health plan or mental health services. In the case of substance abuse, our work for people eligible under the Oregon Health Plan starts with contracts with the fully capitated health plans. But again, when you get to the local level, the essential nonprofit community providers provide the widest array and the greatest amount of substance abuse services to health plan clients. In the mental health structure, we contract with mental health organizations directly for the mental health component of the Oregon Health Plan. And those services are delivered by a combination of county governments, private nonprofits, and private practitioners when that's the appropriate service venue for the client. I think what I want to do next is really start to talk about the reductions. And there are a list in a narrower sense of reductions in your book. I think it starts on page 4-36. But I've gone back beyond that list to try and capture the magnitude of the change the system has experienced for this entire biennium, because it is the source of a lot of the stress, and I'm sure many of the phone calls that you've been receiving from your constituents about inavailability of services. I'm going to start with the kind of reductions, or the reductions in other parts that have impacted the alcohol and drug abuse treatment system. The first major reduction was a loss of about $2.7 million in February of 2002, and that was to the outpatient continuum of care at the local level. We anticipate that that would indicate about 1,179 people would not be able to be served based on that cut. That began destabilizing the local systems of care. There was a smaller reduction, but I think a significant one for the programs, and that was the loss of the cost of living for the second year, even though their employee costs, particularly for health care or other kind of benefits, had gone up. Then there was a major loss to the system with the loss of the chemical dependency benefit to the OHP standard population. Financially, in total funds, that was about $5 million for the remainder of the biennium. Depending on the actual substance abuse provider, it may have made up 60 to 80% of the business that they did and the numbers of people that they served. So it was immensely destabilizing to the system. Then were the targeted cuts that were required by the target set in House Bill 5100, which was tied to Measure 28. We lost 115 alcohol and drug residential treatment beds. That was about $1.7 million in total funds. Those 115 beds over the course of a year would serve about 575 people. That means people with a need clinically determined for a 24-hour level of care for their substance abuse problems simply will be unable to get that service. There was another set of reductions because of the December revenue forecast, and that was a loss of about another $339,000 in outpatient services. There are other kinds of things that have happened that also have a destabilizing effect on the system. As part of the need to reduce, to meet targets for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, eligibility determination has changed so that people, instead of becoming eligible on the day they apply, will now become eligible the first of the month following the month of application. If you have someone who is ready to be treated for a substance abuse problem, they have a history that says they haven't contacted the system, so they don't know one way or the other whether they're Medicaid eligible, you seek to apply and it looks like they're going to be eligible, you can begin serving them. If it's going to be 6 weeks or more before there would be payment for that service, you would have to have either reserves or charity services available, and that is a problem. To ask people to wait until eligibility is determined, one loses that moment in time when service is likely to be most acceptable to the individual. So that's a problem as well. There's another huge risk and concern in the system as we look at the next biennium, because we know what the revenue situation is like, and we know that the possibility of continuing eligibility for people under the Oregon Health Plan who are eligible just because they're poor, not because they belong to one of the federally mandated groups, is very low. If that happens, it's going to further destabilize our alcohol and drug residential system, because we rely on Medicaid outside of the Oregon Health Plan to pay for the treatment component, not the 24-hour housing component, but the treatment component of each alcohol and drug residential bed. Our budget assumes that 80% of the services, or the people that we treat will be eligible for Medicaid. If that pool of eligible people who need that level of care diminishes, it will either force programs to search out categorically eligible people to serve and look at eligibility ahead of clinical need for the level of care, or it will simply cause programs in some parts of the state to close, I'm afraid. So that's a risk that's inherent if we lose another group of people's coverage under Medicaid.
So the standard population, with your assumption, in the Oregon Health Plan, a large percentage of those, you're going to see an AMD.
We see they make up a huge percentage of the people served in outpatient, and they make up about 38% of the people seen in alcohol and drug residential, but they account for a much higher proportion. They account for over half of the bed days used in alcohol and drug residential. So it's a group of people who have high need for intensive alcohol and drug services, and they're not eligible except by virtue of their poverty for the health plan or Medicaid generally.
Senator Shields.
These reductions, would that be part of that 1,800 people that were referred to the other day as being laid off in mental health and alcohol and drug?
The reductions that I talked about that have occurred are what have caused these layoffs that were talked about yesterday. If there are further destabilizations in the system, of course, that will cause additional layoffs.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm not going to talk about the cuts in the state hospital system. You heard about those yesterday from Dr. Mazerhart. I'll turn now to the mental health community system cuts. We've had a series of reductions, again, based on the amount of general fund in the overall mental health system. One of the most devastating, I think, to the system was that by the point we reached the February cuts under Measure 28, we had to eliminate all of the general fund for community crisis services that are in theory available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to respond to people face-to-face who are in a mental health or psychiatric crisis. This has sort of a ripple effect in that counties are no longer able, where they'd organize collaborative arrangements with local emergency departments to help provide an assessment and a determination of the best place to care for somebody in a psychiatric emergency. Unless there are reserves, and some counties are continuing the crisis services for these next 4 months through the use of reserves, local fees, charity donations, that kind of thing. If those things don't exist, and in some communities they don't, then the county's ability to be responsive in those situations is greatly diminished. And that creates a level of stress on the emergency departments at all of the local hospitals.
Madam Chair.
Senator Burley.
Thank you very much. Can you tell us how many counties fit that category of having some reserves that allow them to carry forward for a few more months?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't have that in my head, but we can get that information.
Thank you.
Another cut that's been devastating to the system is in the area of intensive psychiatric day treatment services for children and adolescents. We cut all of the general fund capacity, which was about 132, and what we buy there is a slot, which is several hours a day of this service. Plus, we had to cut 32 slots for Medicaid-eligible kids, so that's a loss of 164 slots in the system. I know it caused what it left was a system funded exclusively with Medicaid. For our programs that serve adolescents, and these adolescents are generally experiencing very early episodes of major mental illnesses, the adolescents sometimes are not Medicaid eligible, and our program in Clackamas County is having to phase out and close because they simply will not be able to stay open with the number of Medicaid eligible kids they would have. We've also had to reduce all of the flexible general fund dollars that go to the counties to serve adults with severe persistent mental illness. Those are the funds that allow the counties to be responsive to local law enforcement, to try and divert people from the front door of the jail, to meet people at the back door of the jail, get them into treatment, assure that they don't cycle through the systems over and over again. Those resources are now gone, and that's creating huge pressures, and we're getting a lot of phone calls about that because the counties simply aren't able to be responsive as they need to be. Temporarily, the same kind of money, the flexible money that was available to serve children, was cut. The legislature was able to restore that in this most recent legislative action. That's through the end of June, and it's unclear what will happen after that. And again, that's the funds that would be available to serve those kids who are seriously ill. Their illness would place them in danger of being removed from their families or being hospitalized, but the family probably has expended and lost, you know, used all of their insurance benefit. The child's not eligible for Medicaid, and so there are no resources available to help those families.
Madam Chair,
Senator Cordley.
Thank you. If we could back up just a few sentences to the telephone calls that you are getting, could you give us some examples of how those telephone calls are being responded to, and what is the volume? What are we telling people at this point?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we have staff sort of tracking reports of critical incidents and that kind of the sort of complaints that we're getting, and we can look and see what that is. And then personally, Bob and I take a number of calls, and at some point what you can do is listen sympathetically and, you know, point people to what resources there might be available, but in some cases, all we can really do is listen and, you know, take the anger they feel at having lost their services.
I think probably two reports that would be of value is the report from the agency, but also I know that the advocacy office also receives complaints coming through that vehicle that we have also routed through that office, and it might be well, and I'll ask Jen Dennison if she will give us the information of the calls and what the resolutions were.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. In addition, you've heard about the importance of employment to people with mental disorders. Because it was a general funded program, we've cut all of the state general fund supported employment programs. I think at the time we made that cut, about 121 people were in service. We have some support employment continuing. It's with the federal block grant and with our evidence-based practice project that Mr. Nichols spoke of yesterday through Dartmouth College. We've made a number of other sort of small cuts just to get to targets. We've reduced our ability to consult with Oregon Health and Sciences University Department of Psychiatry. We cut the only state-funded consumer-operated technical assistance program in the state. We had some money that we had received for caseload growth that we hadn't yet contracted. We had it earmarked for 20-some people that were in the state hospital ready to be discharged. We stopped that process and cut that money as opposed to cutting more people out of service that were not, you know, that were in service in the community where the people in the hospital at least were safe and treated.
One of the questions I think that members receive a lot, and that is we've made cuts in programs at the service level, and what have we done in the administrative or the central office level that are commensurate with what's happening out in the field?
And, Madam Chair, I think on Monday that question was asked, and we agreed to add that information to the table by county and by program type of the layoffs, and staff are preparing that now, and we'll bring it back.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. I have a request from Ms. Olson. As you go forward in describing the cuts, if you could also talk about what has been the impact of the cut thus far, that would be helpful. For example, you talked about the cut to the Office of Consumer and Technical Services. And so what has been the impact of that, or what should we be mindful of as that office goes away?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I'll go back and address that. With the Office of Consumer Technical Assistance, of course, the three or four consumers that worked for that office would have lost their positions, so that's a problem there. In addition, what they did was work throughout the state to help local consumer groups get established, to open drop-in centers, to help train consumers at the local level to be effective voices for the mental health consumer on local advisory bodies, mental health advisory boards, the mental health organization quality assurance committees. So what I think will happen is, unless people can sort of continue to do this on their own, we'll see a diminishing of the consumer voice at the local level as services to meet their needs are planned and executed, as the quality of those services is determined through these functions.
Madeline, you may want to give just a brief overview of what the program and when it was started and what its purpose is, because not every member on this panel is familiar with.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I may have to rely on Mr. Nickel for some memory help here. I think we started contact. This goes back to a consumer-operated treatment program called Mind Empowered, which was in the Portland area, that provided case management services to people that had been hospitalized at Daniel State Hospital. And that program was in operation for a number of years and then ended. And we reserved that funding to try and strengthen the consumer voice in Oregon as we went into the Oregon Health Plan. And, Bob, you can help me remember when we started contracting with the office. I don't.
I'm sure, Senator Gordley, I believe it was about 3 years ago. That, part of the history involves the late Garrett Smith, who many of you knew at one time. And Mr. Smith and I actually had applied for and had a four-year federal grant that allowed the what became later the Office of Consumer Technical Assistance, kind of that was the groundwork for it. And as Madeline mentioned, at the point when the Mind Empowered Incorporated was no longer able to stay in business, we reserved those funds and then created what became the Office of Consumer Technical Assistance. And I believe it was about 3 years ago.
Okay, thank you. One of the things that appeared on our early cut list was the loss of 122 residential beds, 96 in the Portland area, 26 in eastern Oregon in Wallowa County. And we were able, through sort of stopping some projects that were started but not yet contracted, and totally restructuring all three of those residential programs so that we could gather Medicaid, and if you recall from earlier this week, that meant taking them from, one of them was a 50-bed program, one was 46 beds, the other was 26 beds. Those all had to be brought down into 16-bed components that are administered separately so that we can, with a small amount of general fund, we can reserve beds for the people that were in those old beds that were fully general funded. So we've been able to do that restructuring, and although there was quite a lot of publicity in the paper, those people are all safely living in a good community environment and receiving treatment.
And I want to thank you for your hard work, and I want to thank you for your creativeness, because while the press was, you know, with all that was out there, this work was going on with the agency and others to try to make sure as much as possible that people were not harmed. And I want to just personally give the agency a real thank you and the work that you did.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I want to go on the record with the name of the staff person who was doing all of that creative behind-the-scenes work day and night for weeks on end is Carl Rear. And without him, this just wouldn't have happened. We really appreciate it. The mental health benefit under the Oregon Health Plan for the standard population was also lost, and that was about $5.9 million for the last 4 months of this biennium. Again, a major effect on people who aren't eligible otherwise. There have been huge effects of the loss temporarily of the pharmacy benefit. That's now been restored. But another cut that affects the mental health system that isn't really reflected in the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services budget is the loss of the medically needy program. There were several thousand people with major mental disorders on the medically needy program who had work histories or other life circumstances that make them have just too much income for Medicaid, but each month they could accrue a medical expense that would bring their income down. We call that spending down. Then they would be eligible and their prescriptions would be covered under this program. With the loss of that program, these people have been devastated in what they can do to maintain these medications, which are so essential for their well-being. We've done a lot of work to make the various pharmacy scholarship programs known to the population, but those are complicated programs. I believe you have to be signing up for them on an ongoing basis, and not the same medications are covered every month. So it's been a real problem, and I think there are around 6,000 people with major mental illnesses that lost their medical benefit or their medication benefit through that program. So it's had a huge effect on the system. We'll see it rippling into hospitals and people being civilly committed and probably in jails as well.
Madam, would you get me the two things? One, when you said approximately 6,000, and two, within that category, and I'm some estimate of the pharmaceutical cost.
Yes, we would be happy to do that.
Madam Chair?
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Are we actively following or tracking what happens with those 6,000 as, for example, as you were saying, they're being provided with information about the different pharmaceutical programs and et cetera. But is a part of that also following up with folks to find out if they made a contact, if it was a successful contact with the pharmaceuticals? I mean, how far do we go in our follow-up with the 6,000 to make sure that they connect with something in the community?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I'm not sure I can address that specifically, and maybe Mr. Nickel can because I saw him moving over here. One of the things we are doing around all of these cuts is one of the things we've talked about is we did the survey of the counties and the providers to find out the staffing effects, but we're also arranging, and this will be a ways in the future, but to begin to look in other data systems that we have access to look at arrest rates, hospitalization rates, I'm sorry to say this, but death rates,
yes,
of people that have been served in our system that are no longer being served. So we're going to try and have available for our purposes and to share with decision makers what happens when, you know, revenue pictures get the way they are and we have to make the kind of changes that we're having to make.
Would you also check, I understand that Idaho, its utilization of the free and reduced prescription drug program is about three times greater than what we do in Oregon. And I would would like to have some information as to, number one, why is there something that they're, that we could be doing that we're not doing, and get some sense of why they're a lot more aggressive, or if they have someone in place that helps work people through some of the barriers. And if you could check that with Idaho for me, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, we'll follow up on that.
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordon,
if I could just go a little further here. The 6,000 population, that's the group that includes folks who are most vulnerable at becoming hospitalized or homeless or falling into crime. So again, I'm trying to pinpoint, what is our follow-up? What is the system of follow-up we have put in place to stay in touch with those folks and try to get them to some form or fashion of treatment, care, resources in the community?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, maybe I could try to tell you what I know about that. We haven't done anything systematic at this point in trying to track those 6,000 people by name. What we did do about 4 weeks ago was we did a survey out to all of the community mental health programs and asked them, how are these cuts now actually being played out in your community? Because what we began to hear was that different counties had varying abilities to continue services. And as Ms. Olson mentioned earlier, a lot of them, what we learned was that a lot of them are using some reserve funds. Frankly, I think trying to buy some time for their clients and their programs. So my assessment of this right now is that we really haven't seen the full extent of the cutoff yet. The programs are relying on any resources that they can try to use here. But we also heard clearly that come July 1st, they can't continue this indefinitely.
I think that begs then the question, because we asked for the information with respect to how much reserve funds exist within the various, within the county and also within the provider groups that you contact with. And I think that a specific question to them is worth pushing. How many of them have they, of the 6,000 population, are they continuing to serve? If they're not continuing to serve, do they have any idea of where they are, of what's occurred?
Madam Chair, I think those are really useful suggestions, and we'll follow those up.
Yeah.
I could comment, too, that the of the 6,000, it looks like about 3,000 of those people were actually being prescribed their psychotropic medications by their personal care physicians, and so it's about 3,000 of them that appear to have been served by the county mental health programs. We'll follow some of that up.
So I would like to know the universe. If there's 50% of them that are being served by their primary care, then we can deal with that. But if there's a population, if it's another 3,000 that we need to be addressing, particularly as we deal with this issue of pharmaceuticals, and I would like to know that as well.
Exactly. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. In addition, there was money that was cut that never really ended up working in the system because of the timing of the cuts and the circumstances of the funding. The primary source of that was the $6.5 million treatment dollars that had been reserved at the E fund. Oops, there I go. The emergency fund. To be tied to evidence-based practices identified by the counties in their planning that is required in a very extended and comprehensive way under House Bill 3024, which passed last session. Now, those funds, some were cut as they were held at the emergency fund, and then the small amount that was ultimately released to the department ended up being cut as well, again, to try and avoid cutting more people out of service since those funds weren't yet serving anyone. But that was about $6.5 million that was lost to the system. Another cut that, again, is not reflected in this particular budget, but was of very great importance, I think, to the substance abuse and the mental health system was the Oregon Children's Plan money, which was held in the Office of Medical Assistance Program budget. It started at about $11.5 million. The purpose of that money was to serve parents of children from really birth or pre-birth through age 8, if the parent's substance abuse problem put the child at risk of developing later problems, or if the parent's mental health problem put the child at risk, or if the child's own mental health problem put the child at risk. So those funds were used for a very brief period of time in the beginning months of the biennium, but after that they were cut.
I continue to get calls from individuals wanting to know why we hadn't cut it. They didn't know that it was already gone.
Yeah. Those funds were cut quite early in the process, I think, again, because they weren't yet serving individuals. I talked specifically about some of the kinds of things we could expect to see because of these reductions. Generally, the loss of the state general fund erodes the flexibility at the local level for the systems, either substance abuse or mental health, to be responsive outside of the constraints of the funding stream restrictions or outside of eligibility restrictions. Those are the funds that let them be responsive to local law enforcement, to local public schools, to local partners of other kinds, to provide the kind of services that the partners need for folks in their responsibility in order to be successful. So that's a kind of a general loss to the system. Particularly, this is critical, and I think I'll be repeating things Mr. Nickel said, but I think it's so critical it bears repeating. This is an incredible loss in the child welfare system. If children are removed from their home because of problems created by parents' substance abuse, the children are gone. In many cases, those parents will not be eligible for Medicaid. Yet, they need to get treatment for the substance abuse problem in order to fulfill their obligations to be reunited with their children. The funding available to do that has been greatly eroded. That's going to be a huge problem as we move forward in the next months. And we're working with our colleagues in Child, Adolescent, and Family Services to try and find ways of ameliorating that. But it's a substantial problem, and it's a risk for the state.
Members, I have flagged that issue two reasons. One, the state does have a obligation and a responsibility of under our statute, but the federal statutes, to work to reunite the families, and if that can't occur, then they're to move towards termination of parental rights. And it behooves us to have done all that we can before we move towards the termination. And so I have asked the agency to look at how we can link in a priority basis those services that we know that by law we're required to do, so that we're beginning to rank and tie those together. Madeline is absolutely correct that it not only does it cause the problems for the families, but I know that the Juvenile Rights Group is sitting there waiting, and it's going to create some legal issues for us as well if we don't begin to make sure that we're tying some of these issues together.
And I think I mentioned earlier, but these flexible local resources are those which allow the counties and the nonprofit providers to be responsive to the local sheriffs, the local jails, to work with people with mental disorders or substance abuse disorders who are incarcerated locally. And again, it creates strains on any collaborative arrangements that were made between local providers and hospital emergency rooms.
Representative Smith.
In these treatment programs for adults, how many times are they able to go through the program for treatment?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, are you speaking of people with substance abuse disorders?
Yes. Like, they go through the program and they're clean for a while, then they go back to the abusive behavior. Are they put again on the program?
That might be the case. I'm going to defer to Mr. Nickel on this one, who has clinical background, which I don't have.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think the best way to think about it is that the consensus of opinion that alcohol and drug issues are chronic diseases. Mm-hmm. And so relapse really has to be expected, mm-hmm. and not that it's wanted, but it will happen, just like people have, you know, ongoing difficulties with managing diabetes or heart disease. So there is no administrative rule that restricts the number of times somebody would go through a treatment program.
So once or twice, three or four or five times, six?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we could get some data, I think, the number of people who have a certain number of episodes of treatment within a specified period of time. It would be an interesting thing to look at. I don't know the answer to that, but I believe our data systems would allow us to get some impression of that.
Just a comment.
Mm-hmm.
Because if children are involved in this family situation, say it's a family situation, and the children are continually removed because the parent, you know, has continuing habitual drug use. And let's say the children are permanently removed. Will then that parent go back into the system for more therapy?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, maybe I misunderstood part of your question earlier.
Well, no, you didn't.
The issue of whether a person can return to treatment is essentially based on that person's willingness, or if they're mandated, if the court tells them that they have to go, then that opens the front door there. The issue of whether they have a certain number of chances in the process of whether they're going to keep their kids or not is really something that's obviously in the court's jurisdiction.
Griffin Smith, the statutes that guide the movement towards termination of parental rights, there's a year's period that's there, and it is linked to substance abuse, by the way. And the agency has a requirement under the statute to move that case when they cannot get results from the parents. So I know you probably have received some letters from individuals who will say, well, you know, the state had no right of taking my children. But this is also all under the umbrella of the court, you know, of the court's jurisdiction, and that's why I said what I did earlier. Mm-hmm. We have a responsibility to carry out the court piece, which is a part of the federal law as well as our statute, in trying to make sure, because a piece of that says that we must do what all that we can to provide the services to try for reuniting first.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're not successful in doing that, then you must move towards termination.
Can I make just one comment? So if adults who do not have children, am I to assume then that that program is available to them for as often as they need to use it? So is it isn't a blank check for recovery treatment?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'm not really sure how to answer that, other than I believe that it's people come in for treatment as they're either required to by the courts or if they volunteer. But I can again tell you that most of our experience is that people don't usually volunteer for often not even mental health treatment, but certainly not alcohol and drug treatment. So I think it would surprise me if there was much of a revolving door, but we'll look at some of our data on that.
Thank you. Well, it's really not necessary that you dig through the data. You don't need to do that work. I'm just trying to get a feel here for what's going on.
I think the majority of the cases are court-ordered.
Okay.
And also, which would be interesting for this panel to have the information of, some of those are court-ordered that go to the alcohol and drug treatment, they also are required in some cases to pay for those services. Not all of these services is being paid by the state.
Okay.
I guess I need to put that on record too.
Yeah. Good question. Thank you.
Continue.
That really concludes the specific kinds of reductions. Now, just one final note on that. those reductions occurred primarily beginning February 1, and the system's doing what it can to sort of piece things together, but as we look at the next 24 months, the magnitude of the reductions will begin to be felt in a much deeper way, I think. So that's kind of what I want to leave that with, I believe. If it's desirable, I'm prepared to talk in a rather general way about what's in the governor's balanced budget, although I'm mindful of the fact that it's going to be redone and the revenues have changed, and so I don't know if that's relevant or the best use of our time today.
Well, I think, and I think this panel is aware that the governor's budget is going to be redone in April, which is around the corner. And if you just want to do some overarching highlights, that's fine. But as far as specific details, I think we're pretty much aware that we know that we're going to be looking at different figures. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair. It would be helpful for me to get kind of a global perspective of the numbers. And I think, LFO, if we could go back to your memorandum, it doesn't have a page number, but it does have your shows the general fund, lottery funds, other funds, federal funds for mental health and addiction, but it doesn't show what the Measure 28 reductions were. And it would be helpful for me to look at the 9901, and then I assume the 0103 legislatively adopted is at the end of session. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Senator Morse, that's correct. Adopted is what we came out with at the end of the 2001 session.
And do we know now what our revised rebalanced amount is?
For the end of 03? Madam Chair and Senator Morse, I'm not certain that we know. The problem that we've had with the DHS budget, frankly, has been that we reorganized the budget along the lines of the DHS reorganization. I can tell you what we have as far as the legislatively approved budget for the mental health division, which is a portion of this program, of this cluster, and I can tell you what the budget is, the current budget, for the Office of Alcohol Abuse and Prevention, which is also a portion of this cluster. What I can't tell you, to my satisfaction, is what those numbers are that are missing in that box. So I can tell you pieces of the puzzle, but this is a problem in terms of comparing this particular program because it pulls pieces from different divisions, different budgets into one cluster, and that's the problem that we've been facing.
You know, just looking at these numbers across as they've moved, and the governor's recommended $470 million, it doesn't, and all of the reductions we're talking about, which are listed in your analysis here, $48.8 million, and then to jump back to $470 million, something just doesn't add up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't get a grasp of what's happening here because it doesn't, something isn't ringing true.
And I would concur with you, absolutely.
Is there some days that we will have that information?
Well, let me turn to the department. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse and Mr. Britton, I think that's a question that our office will need to defer to Margie Johnson. And here she is.
Thank you, Bob. My name is Margie Johnson. I'm an acting assistant director for finance with the department. The frustration that John is expressing is because of the complication that has occurred over the course of this biennium with our budget. The budget authority that we have for this biennium is contained in our old division structures. And with the recasting of the budget to correspond to the new cluster organization structure, we've been keeping track of things during this biennium, both by division in the old way, and then transferring those costs to the new cluster structure. Come the new biennium, everything will go to the new cluster structure. Overall, we can track through the expenditures that have occurred in the old structure and show you where they go in the new structure. But in some cases, as John was describing, what's happening is that you're pulling costs from other areas that weren't in a particular division and then including them. And vice versa, we're taking costs, for instance, some of the centralized administrative support functions that the divisions used to provide are now provided centrally, so we're sending money from one area to a central department-wide support services. So overall, bottom line for the department, we can do this analysis. It becomes much more complicated when we take it piece by piece, portion by portion.
And Madam Chair and Senator Morris, if I may also, some of the programs, for example, the CHIP program, which is a smaller program and it's at the top of that page, is very easy to track. And we probably could get the legislatively approved budget because not much has happened to it, but it's also been tracked separately. The problem with the one that you've pointed to is, as Margie said, that it's drawing pieces from various old divisions and trying to put them into a new cluster level.
Yeah, sure, thank you. The reorganization you're referring to, what point in time did that occur?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, from an operational or organizational perspective in terms of the management of the organization, that occurred a little about a year and a half ago. It was, but in terms of the actual budgeting and accounting, the budget reorganization doesn't occur technically until July 1 of 2003, with the enactment of our what will be our new legislatively approved authority under the new structure.
Madam Chair, I have to express some indignation at us being asked to make decisions without information.
Well, you can express your indignation. And I accept it. The thing of it is that they're operating under trying to bring forward an old system in a form to a new system. And I know we had this discussion when we talked about the reorganization and the difficulty that it was going to pose for county when you start bringing in divisions and putting them into a cluster. And part of it is the state's method of accounting. The other piece of it is the IT technology that was supposed to assist in some of this, that we removed their dollars.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, we do, and I can provide a crosswalk that takes it at least shows you where major portions of expenditures were directed. So we can work with some of the detail with staff and do that track from 0103 legislatively adopted to where we are now.
Margie, can you, when the governor presents his new budget, his new figures, can you have that kind of detail available for this body when we get the new figures?
Madam Chair, yes, I believe we can.
That would be,
I think partly it's a little frustrating because we're dealing with budget figures that were put together before, one, we had the other budgetary changes which have been made by this, when we passed the other bill. So we're actually operating back in a budget that was given to us in 2002. And things have changed. And that's why you're going to have a new budget coming in next month. So if you could have those figures, if you could have the ability to give us the detail when we get the new figures from you and budget and management, I didn't say the word, Mr. McNaughton, I got it right, then that would be helpful to this panel. So I think for now, these are not even valid. Your budgetary figures within this book that we have before us will all change. Am I not correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. And I know that legislative fiscal staff were at a disadvantage because of the timing of some of these adjustments. And we will try to get as close as we can in terms of tracking back through that, and we'll work with staff to do that.
Perhaps for the record, I should remind everyone, even though we started a regular session in January, from my perspective and those of us who've been around, we went to a 6 special session.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And having gone through a 6 special session, that hasn't caught up with us for the budget for 0305. I think that's probably can put it into its good framework. And so legislative fiscal is waiting for the information that they receive from the agency and from budget and management. Budget and management and the agencies are all trying to correlate their information to be caught up to date. So we're in this period, and the co-chairs are pushing on us to get our work done. And so that's why we're having the overviews rather than having work sessions. I realize that, you know, you need the technical information. Under normal circumstances, what we would have done when we did the budget is that we would have an overview, and then we would immediately go into work session on these budgets. We're delaying the work sessions until we can get all the specific information back from the agency, if that's helpful.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And then everybody's going to have a crash cram course. So we'll probably have evening meetings. Yeah. I could have. Go ahead, Mark. Thank you very much. The reality is we probably will have evening meetings, and so just be prepared.
That's right.
Continue.
Okay. Before I go to just some really high-level comments about the governor's balance budget, and I have a little bit of information about its relationship with the 0103 budget, but not much, I want to be clear. When we were talking about substance abuse treatment and the mandated populations, we were focusing mostly in our comments about child welfare cases. There are other parts of the legal system that rely on the stability and the existence of the substance abuse treatment programs. The drug courts, which you heard referred to earlier this week, also the programs for people who are convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants, the diversion programs. Those folks are required to go into treatment. Also certain felony crimes. And even if these people have to pay, they have to have a provider system that's competent and credentialed that they can pay for their treatment in order to meet their legal obligations. So that's another area of legal risk, really, as the system becomes more and more eroded. And with that, I'll talk just a little bit about the governor's balanced budget. The governor's balanced budget for alcohol, drug prevention, and treatment for 0305 is $86.4 million. That includes $6.7 million in lottery funds for the Problem Gambling Prevention and Treatment Program. It's a reduction of $19.3 million from where we were in 0103. The amount for community mental health treatment is $177.4 million. That's a loss of $32.3 million as things stand at the moment.
Excuse me, Madam, one question.
Or could you direct us to some reference point in the notebook?
I'm sorry, this material isn't in this form in the notebook. I've pulled this from 7 or 8 different sources. I can have my notes typed and made available to you.
Well, maybe just a suggestion is that all of these points that you're talking about in numbers, some way they get rolled up into some comprehensive document that we're looking at that we were referencing earlier. So that would be a request that I would have.
Madeline, in terms of the, especially the, I started asking the question yesterday about the gambling addiction dollars, and according to your information that this budget will have at least 90% of the 0103 level, there will be decreases up to 40%. Am I reading this right, John? 440.
Madeline, did you find the page? It's 440. It looks like this was a proposal to reduce lottery funds for gambling, but it was not included in the governor's budget.
I would, Madam Chair, I would need to do a little more research on this. I read the language, but it's not making... It's not jogging my brain here, so we can get back to you on that.
Yeah, I'd like Barry.
As a part of statute, Madam Chair, I believe we're required to bring forward this Barry Cass.
Yeah.
To bring forward a set of targets at 90%, not only for general funds, but also for other funds, federal funds, lottery funds. This package, which would have reduced the lottery budget, was not included in the governor's budget because the lottery specifically dedicates 1% of lottery revenues to gambling addiction treatment.
Right, and
we're making a record for you here of what, as we were asked to do in the format,
exactly.
Of what wasn't included as well as what was.
Okay, so my question, since it comes through your department, is that right? The dollars, 1% of the lottery fund dollars for gambling addiction comes to through your department.
Yes, Madam Chair, they go into an account which is continuously appropriated for this purpose.
Okay, my question to you is for this panel to have some information on those dollars in terms of what reductions that went through the five special sessions, if there were any, and any proposed reductions that are going to come about. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Madam.
Madam Chair, we'll bring that.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes.
Senator Gourley.
Thank you. My question goes back to the question that Senator Morris was raising about the numbers that you're giving us now. And I would just ask if we could just back up a bit and if you could give us those numbers again so that I can better track what you're telling us and better track where you're headed next.
Madam Chair, Senator Gourley, I'll do it and I'll try to do it a little more slowly.
Thank you.
I think Madeline, you're doing a good job of doing that. I think that they just want a copy of the numbers so that that the numbers can be a part of our our thinkings.
And Madam Chair, these are handwritten notes. Like I said, I pulled them from a number of tables, and we'll get those to you. The caveat will be what we've been talking about. These are numbers off of a budget that will cease to exist shortly and be replaced by a different one.
Okay. Thanks.
Again, the alcohol drug prevention.
Excuse me for a minute. Ms. Representative Smith, do you have a question?
No,
okay.
Thank you.
The alcohol drug prevention and treatment budget is $86.4 million in the governor's balance, including the $6.7 million in lottery funds for gambling prevention and treatment, and it's a reduction of about $19.3 million. The amount for community mental health is $177.4 million, a loss of $32.3 million. The state hospitals have $206.9 million. That's a slight increase of $27.1 million over their 0103 budget. There's $21.9 million in program support. As we count our organization chart, that's about 90 positions. If you were to count the positions in the governor's balanced budget, it's more than that. But those positions don't reflect positions that have been eliminated through some of the reductions and positions that have been transferred out of the office.
Okay, help my brain. Maybe I am receiving what you're saying, but let me just double check. We are losing approximately 90 positions in mental health.
Mental health and addictions. Losing. No, that's how many positions we have.
Okay.
If I look at our organization chart and I count the positions, it's 90 in what we call program support. If you were to go to the governor's balanced budget, you would see a number about 10 higher than that because it hasn't been adjusted for cuts that have occurred.
Okay, Madam Chair, just asking a question here. And of those 90 people in alcohol and the area of mental, how many are we losing in that area according to budget cuts?
With the very last set of budget cuts, we lost 5 positions. Throughout the biennium, from the beginning with the restructuring, the bringing together of the two offices, the moving away of some functions, we've lost about 15.
I want to respond, Madam Chair, to try and hook it into the numbers in the LFO. The numbers that Madeline just recited total to about the $470.7 million for total funds, mental health and addiction services. In addition, she mentioned about $21 million, Madeline, that goes into a different budget section, which is the program support and central admin in our write-up. But the 470 ties in to the governor's budget amount in the LFO write-up.
Mm-hmm. But that you will have to do. You're going to do a new write-up, correct?
Right. Madam Chair.
Well, I just think we know all these numbers have been moving and changing ever since the first of the year in this building. And, you know, we struggled with it with Representative Westland and I and others in trying to get our hands around the Oregon Health Plan and working in the stakeholders group. And we recognize that they are moving, and we're hoping that soon we can come to a place where the figures aren't so fluid. Is that about a good way Wes is taking his head?
May 15th,
when we have our forecast.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
I just have a need to say to the department as they come here, I don't mean to be antagonistic or try to put you on the line, but it's just when you've been called upon to do a job in terms of balancing the budget and looking at numbers from a department and you don't have them, because these 5 sessions had to take their toll on how you guys have kept up with numbers and also the department changes and DAS as well as you guys not necessarily having the numbers. But I feel the frustration of us trying to do a job and then not having the numbers here to do it. So all of us are going to have to bear through this together.
Madam Chair, if I could add for just a second. I've worked with the Department of Human Services for about 6 years now working on their budget. And this cycle has been that worst-case storm it could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
The same time that the department's been working through its reorganizations, which means that you have programs are shifting from place to place. And we can track with, I believe, a great deal of accuracy the core programs, the Oregon Health Plan, the CHIP programs. I will put in my money when I get ahead of myself. I have a lot to pay in this one. those core programs we can track very, very accurately, I think. Where we get into trouble is where some of the bodies are for the program support pieces, the central administration pieces, because they are being centralized. We're asking them, they're doing things differently than they've done in the past. Until that reorganization kind of shakes out, the picture is pretty muddy as to what bodies are doing what functions within the department. That is starting to shake out, and in that time, we've had a change in leadership in the department. We have had not only the 5 or 6 special sessions that you all have gone through, we've had 4 rebalance plans that have reshot all of these caseloads. For the Oregon Health Plan by itself, what you see as one caseload is actually 9 or 10 different caseloads that I see and Mr. Britton sees. On top of that, we've had, I think, 2 or 3 different unschedulings that the governor has set up. all of those are being priced by the same core group of people. As I have put requirements on them to put the budget together, your legislative fiscal office has done the same thing, and the internal process of doing rebalances have all been going on at the same time. All of us need to have the information, and all of us want to have the best, most accurate information that we can. The problem, quite simply, is it's five or six people within each one of these clusters doing the same work for three or four different masters. And so we do appreciate very much your patience with us as we try and pull these things together.
I'm going to state it another way, because you also have, and we've tried to keep this session it at a minimum. He said three or four different masters, but they also receive requests from our other members. And so there are 90 of us in this building, and I'm very mindful of the workload that our staff have had and the executive staff have had in order to try to meet all these needs in a very changing environment. The environment has changed. When we left this building, I don't think it's any way that we thought we were going to be in here five special sessions. And, you know, I just ran into one of the legislative fiscal officers, and if you have followed the illnesses that have been going on in this building that's going around, and I think we have worked our staff to a maximum capacity on both sides of the aisle. And I would encourage us to be a little patient. The governor will be giving us new figures. Those will be the figures we will begin to start working with. We will then begin to start getting into our work sessions. But until that occurs, you know, I believe that we still need to have the overviews from the agencies and to continue that part of what is our responsibility, so that when we do get the detailed budgets, we have a better an understanding at least of the program frameworks and what goes into those programs, so that we can make some informed decisions. But we need to have just a couple more weeks of patience. And allowing our staff to do their job, and I'm sure that the numbers will begin to not be as fluid as they have been in the past. Representative Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two points. One is just to flesh out a little bit what George is saying, and I know all of us on the committee appreciate, but I remember when I was first sitting down with Mr. Britton and some of the comparative runs of the different clusters when they were first coming out trying to get the 99.01 compared to the 0103 data, they'd have some numbers. We'd have no idea if they were good. But remember those worksheets where they just produced 0000? I mean, there was no way to get that comparative information. So I think the department has really done yeoman's work in getting us to the point where we are today. The second point is that every time I sit down at one of these 101 overviews, I remember it. I never fail to learn something else. There is always something I pick up in these presentations that I did not know before, that I take away, that allows me to be a better decision maker, a better legislator, better policy maker. So I appreciate you guys being here, and I think all of us up here know what you're going through. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
A last couple of comments about the governor's balanced budget, and then I think I'll turn it over to Bob for some concluding remarks. I'm not even going to try and talk about the health plan numbers because there's going to be so much work left to be done there. But the loss of the OHP standard mental health and chemical dependency benefit for 0305 amounts to about 100 and $5.5 million total funds for the mental health and substance abuse system. The most notable thing about this budget, I think Barry was very eloquent about on Monday, and that's the shift of where we've been for the last 10 years of moving resources into the community, supporting people near their homes. This budget, for the first time in a long time, has more resources in the institutional settings and fewer in the community settings. So less ability to support people in their communities, not enough support in the communities to preclude the pressure that we're going to have on the state hospital from people civilly and criminally committed. So there are risks there.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd just like to summarize a few things here. It won't take very long. Before I do that, I would really like to genuinely express our appreciation to you, because this has been a very attentive audience for us, and we appreciate the questions and the challenges, and I just want to thank you for what you've shown here. I think given what we know right now about the potential shortages of resources, I just want to comment that I think we have some real vulnerabilities here to a system that, although it at times has had its problems, it's been holding together, I think, sometimes very amazingly well over quite a few years. One of the things that I'm really concerned, and we've talked a lot about the potential impact on real people, and there are thousands of Oregonians who could be impacted by this, and my next comments are not meant to minimize that. That's really the headlines, I think. However, the infrastructure, I think, is what I lay awake at night these days worrying about. I think about the state hospital. The state hospital can manage with the kind of numbers that we've had. But it's done that in large part because we have had enough of an opportunity to invest in community services. And that's a fairly well-known phenomenon around the country. The more you invest in community services, the less you have to invest in really expensive state hospital care. That's also true at the local and acute care level, I would add. I'm really concerned about the vulnerability of the largely privatized alcohol and drug system. While there's a lot of interest in privatizing things, we've largely done that in the alcohol and drug treatment area. And those providers are hurting right now. And if we close some of the programs, or if they have to close, it's going to be very difficult to reopen them. And I'm sure you're all aware of that, but I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't end up making a few comments about our concern about those things. The county-based mental health system also has a fair amount of vulnerability, and as you're all aware, Multnomah County, with their Verity contract, actually gave it back to us at one point, and we're pleased, as Representative Westland, I think, announced yesterday, that they're going to see their way through at least another 30 days. That's really good news. We do not want to operate a state-operated Multnomah County system. That would not be a good thing, in my opinion.
Bob, we had some discussions, and perhaps some members of this panel should know about it, is that counties can, by statute, have the first option with programs. And the issue of Multnomah County was one that I was aware of during the special sessions and the problems that they were incurring and the possibility of the state assuming responsibility. And I think there was a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of concern, because the question becomes, is the state itself in a position to do it? And I think the response, if you ask the staff, is that we weren't tooled. I mean, we didn't have the tools to assume the job of Multnomah County that Multnomah County was doing. And so sometimes it seems simple on the surface to say that, well, we just moved to a different method or a different structure, but you still have to ask the question, do you have the capacity or the capability to do it? So,
Madam Chair, I can only say I very much share your sentiments there. And I, as one of the key people looking at some of what the options would look like, they weren't particularly attractive. If we had to do it, we would do it, but it would be a real stretch. And I think I'd also just like to comment on the vulnerability that other state and local resources, state government, local government, particularly around courts, around juvenile justice, child welfare, community hospitals, I think are all of depending in large part on the kinds of community services that we're able to offer in mental health and alcohol and drug services in the state. And so those are impacts that may be felt down the line. I'm sure you're as aware of these as I am, but I just wanted to make sure that as I summarize the concerns and the issues that I put those on the record. I look forward to whatever steps we take together from here. I think we have an office that's willing and able to be creative. I think we've demonstrated that. We look forward to doing our best to work with whatever budget we end up with. So I conclude with my remarks.
Yeah, I've just always been, as you, really concerned, and you put it pretty well. I like your outline that you've just given us. But you talk about the vulnerability of a largely privatized drug and alcohol system at the state. It is vulnerable. If it comes apart, how do you begin to get a handle on the costs to the state, to its citizenry, to the courts of the demise of that system? I mean, I know in one sense it's a hypothetical question, but dagnabbit, it's going to cost a lot of money, and it's going to affect a lot of people's quality of life. And even if it's a hard question, and even if it's a hypothetical question or, you know, whatever, we need to try and get an answer. I mean, this is a committee that deals with numbers, and I keep running back and forth between this committee and the Health Policy Committee a couple days a week because it's dealing with the policy end of it. But these numbers are going to affect an awful lot of people's lives. Maybe it's because I spent several years living down in Chiloquin, Fort Klamath, Klamath Falls, and saw what was being done out in the field and yanking those out of that community is
Senator Shields, I think that they will be looking to us for some policy direction, and because that's really a broad hypothetical question that I think that alone they cannot answer. But I also would like to ask you a question, because I haven't heard that term used in a long time. Dagnabbit?
Well, I'll tell you what. That's a term that comes when you're frustrated enough to use four-letter words and you find a good way around it. The minister doesn't use it.
Is that what my dad was saying all those years?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I had not heard that.
Actually, maybe we've interrupted this good gentleman, because I thought he was almost at the point of making a few comments in response to that hypothetical question, and I wouldn't want to see him cut off.
Well, he's welcome to try that, Dag.
Madam Chair, I wonder if I could preempt Mr. Nickel here and say it would be very difficult for us to provide hypothetical numbers, but as we built these programs, we came to you and said, these programs will avoid cost in the future. And we had estimates of what those costs were. The same applies in the other direction. That is to say, when we disinvest, we have to anticipate the costs that we were avoiding. And you've heard some testimony here that in alcohol and drug abuse, that the savings from treatment are about 5 to 1, maybe more, maybe less. Bob was equivocated a little, because it whatever the argument, whatever level those savings are, they are significant. And those estimates, I guess, can be made. Mm-hmm. But we are also, as we pointed out yesterday, tracking the effect of these budgetary changes through specific indicators. We have the data for that, and we will be able to tell you over time, and because these things roll over time, it's going to take a while to see what's happening here. We'll be able to tell you what the effects are on health status and juvenile crime and those kinds of things. We know how to track those numbers, and we'll be able to bring them back.
Senator Hill.
Madam Chair, I sat on this committee in 1999, and I'm glad Barry just mentioned this, because they talk about avoiding costs in the future, and I want to put that in juxtaposition to a circuit court judge who sat there and said, every dollar you spend on alcohol and drug treatment will save us $5. So another way to get the handle on the cost of especially the DNA is to use that yardstick. If that judge was here today, he'd still be saying every dollar you spend in drug and alcohol will save you $5, so every dollar we disinvest is going to cost us $5. That's the other way to look at it.
Madam Chair, you can see in this budget, when you look at the numbers that Madeline was giving you, the growth in the cost of the state hospital is already apparent to us. And many of those patients come from the metro area where there has been strain on resources for a number of years. As she pointed out, there's more than $20 million in growth in the state hospital budget. And as I was sitting there, I said to myself,
we're cutting the budget. Why is the state hospital growing? I want to point out, and it bears mentioning again, we opened a new ward this biennium. We delayed one, which is scheduled to open July 1st, and there's two more wards scheduled. That's 120 beds. We're running a 600-bed hospital, so there's a 20% increase in capacity at Oregon State Hospital at the end of this biennium if we don't do something different. And that also gives us some options in this budget, and I hope as we look at the governor's revised and you see a more reliable set of figures that we'll be able to explore those options with you in work session.
Looking forward to it. Is there any other questions? Dr. Bates, you came in. No questions?
No questions.
All right. Senator Gordley?
Just one of the concerns I have, as we've been talking over the past several days now, is for our employees who are working under incredible amounts of stress. And I'm wondering, are you seeing an increase in numbers of employees who are taking advantage of employee assistance programs? I mean, how are people coping with their own stress and their own, I would think that there's a grieving process going on around all these wonderful employees who've invested in many cases years helping to build programs that we're now dismantling in a matter of months. And you know, how are people doing, and what are we doing? Are we doing enough to support them?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I can't quantify that, but it's an interesting question to pose to our human resources staff, because they know the answers to those questions. We've certainly seen a dramatic increase in retirements of people in roughly my age bracket. But my subjective response. late 40s, I'm talking about. My subjective response to that is that there has been an enormous grieving process, not just because of the budget, but because of the amount of change that has occurred. Mm-hmm. And people can take so much change, and then things begin to wear. But to quantify that, I think, would take some additional work. There's one more factor, and that is we've been holding vacancies now for about 9 months. There are over 1,000 vacant positions in the department, and we ordinarily have something like 300 as a part of the natural turnover. But the workload hasn't gone down, and so people are you see, there is an enormous commitment on the part of the employees of the department to get work done. And it's a commitment in every area that has to do with why people got there in the first place. And I think over time, it's going to be very difficult for people to sustain that level of energy and activity. So it's something that we worry about, not only in terms of keeping who we've got, but attracting the next generation of workers to human services. This is a very dismal place to stop, but I do want to thank the committee and also to just recognize that when we started on Monday, we set some goals for this, and my own view is that we've achieved them. We have a pretty good sense of what we do and what some of the trends are and what some of the risks are, and I think that's pretty much where we wanted to be by the end of this week. I appreciate that.
I appreciate that, and I also want to add, you're not 75. So I don't care what she'll say, you know.
Senator Carnell was 80 this morning.
Yeah, so anyway, you're in good company here with the rest of this panel. I thank you for your testimony, and Bob Nichols, I thank you, and I know, you know, taking on this new responsibility that you will do well. And we look forward to when you come back with more detail and we go through the budget. And to the members of this panel, have a nice day in district tomorrow. Yours truly, since she lives in Salem and she doesn't get to travel in district, and she's behind in some of her work, she will be here in the office playing catch up tomorrow. So while I'm playing catch up, you guys meet with your constituents and have an excellent, excellent weekend. The sun's going to shine all the rest of this week, and we will look forward to Monday. And I have to share with you something that on a good note that I'm reminded of, that Governor Tia told me. That's for us not to forget that as we go through this process, and even and we're looking at these budgets and they look bad now, that the economy in Oregon will not always stay here at this level. And let's not forget that. I don't want us to think in terms of that we're that there is not some light somewhere in this tunnel. So with that, my friends, we are adjourned.
Thank you.